Recorded live from around British Columbia, Canada, this is Ramsey Theory. No strangers at this party. In this program, students of Ramsey Theory investigate the deepest questions in the field and dig into the lives of the most notable modern theorists. The podcast is hosted by Simon Fraser University, which is located on the unceded traditional territories of the Tsleil-Waututh, Coquitlam, Squamish, and Musqueam nations. This podcast was made possible by the students of Simon Fraser University's Ramsey Theory course, led by Dr. Veselin Yungich, who is also the producer of this series, as well as funding from the Mathcatcher Outreach Program. Stay tuned, because this is Ramsey Theory, no strangers at this party.
Hello and welcome everyone to Ramsey Theory, no strangers at this party. My name is Anmol Singh and I will be hosting this podcast today with my partners Amrita Raj.
Hey everyone.
And Brian Kramer.
Hello.
We are undergraduate students at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia studying mathematics, and we hope to learn more about maths, Ramsey Theory, and of course, notable Ramsey theorists through this podcast.
My name is Brian Kramer, and I'm a fourth-year student here at SFU in Burnaby, British Columbia. I'm finishing up my Bachelor of Arts in English Literature, and I'm minoring in mathematics. I hope to become a teacher one day and teach both English and mathematics, and so naturally that drew me to this project of interviewing mathematicians and getting to know the people behind the mathematics.
I'm Amrita. I'm an engineering student at SFU, majoring in systems engineering and minoring in mathematics. I'm from India and have been here in Canada for about 5 years. Mathematics is a subject that I really enjoyed throughout my school years. What I love about math is that it has no limits. It fascinates me. The formula, the theorems, the logic. The euphoria of completing a particularly hard puzzle, or the sudden realization of a particular topic clicking into place, makes the challenge and the hard work all the more worthwhile. And for this very reason, I got into class Ramsey Theory, Complete Chaos is Impossible.
So we have the pleasure to host today with one of the most renowned Ramsey theorists of our time. He's Barbara J. Jansen, professor at Iowa State University. He earned his master's degree in 2003 from Brigham Young University. After writing the dissertation, Eigenvalues and Structure of Graphs, advised by another renowned mathematician, Dr. Frank Chung, he was awarded his PhD from USC San Diego. Now he has been teaching mathematics for about 20 years. According to the website Rate My Professor, 91% of his students say they would take his class again. And last but not least, our own professor, Dr. Jungik, described him as larger than life personality. Dr. C. Butler, thank you for coming here.
Oh, well, thank you. Now you can't tell because this is on the screen, but one of the reasons me have said larger than life is I'm actually about 6.5 feet tall. So physically, it's definitely very applicable.
So in our emails exchange, you said that your semester was going very interesting. So what are you working on right now?
Well, it's been an interesting semester for me. I'm teaching differential equations for the first time. And
wow.
So the last time I touched a differential equation, I was a graduate student. Mm-hmm. And so it's been interesting for me to learn the subject again.
I see.
But as far as math goes, I'm working on a book about math of juggling. And so I'm working with a particular student, and we have this sort of fun idea of generalization of Eulerian numbers. So, and we're working out the details right now.
Okay, your book on juggling. I saw your video on juggling as well. I thought the thumbnail on that one, I thought it was Photoshopped, but I guess I underestimated your commitment to the art. How is the juggling science, the mathematics of juggling, do you think is like applicable in like art? Everyday life?
Well, so one of the things I tell people is that, you know, if I just say math of juggling, it's like, oh, that sounds like fun. But I could say, oh, it's the mathematics of periodic discrete patterns. I'm like, whoa, periodic discrete patterns, that like sounds really important, you know, let's give you some money to study that. And so really what's happening is when we're talking about using jugglings, you know, there's two things. There's the idea here is that things repeat. That's what we mean by periodic. And so the pattern repeats over time. And the discrete, you might say, well what's discrete about the pattern? Well, excuse me, it comes to how we actually describe it. And so oftentimes we can think about there's like a ticking beat, bup, 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 bup. And what do you do at every beat? So for example, jugglers oftentimes think of sight swap. And that's like, okay, you throw it, what do you do with the ball in your hand? It's very actually practical. It's like, okay, I've got a ball and I only have one beat to do something with it. What do I do with it right now? And so there's various things you can do with it. Each one has a number and that number tells you how to throw it so that it lands maybe five beats or maybe two beats in the future. And so that's the discrete nature of it. But there's other things that you could describe as periodic and discrete. A lot of communication signals are fall into that category. But the one I like to also point out is drumming. Right. And so one of the ways I actually first started thinking about it was somebody said, well, how would you describe juggling if you were in zero gravity? Because, you know, you throw the ball, it's going to take a while. But what you can do is you can say, okay, instead of you throwing the ball stays where it is. In fact, you can have several balls lined up. And then what you do is you just move your hands. And you say, okay, ball, green, blue ball, ball, right, back and forth. And it's like, well, wait, what you're describing there is it's just changing your perspective from, you know, what do the hands do to, well, okay, change your perspective to the balls. But that's the same thing that you see with drumming. So anything that's periodic and discrete, that's the same mathematics. It's one of the nice things about mathematics is its flexibility and how you can take something in one setting and adapt it very easily to some new setting. I heard a lovely talk by Manjula Bhargava, who was a Fields medalist. And he came and there was a conference. And he brought some Indian drums and he talked about the patterns. And
called tablas.
Right, and there's different patterns and different ways that communicate, and he would demonstrate with it. And he'd often talk about, well, he'd sometimes spend his days drumming, you know, and like, okay, then he could go and prove theorems. Uh-huh. There's other people who have talked about how various famous composers sort of would explore strange, like four-dimensional shapes actually through their music when you think about how their music is played. I think also, I want to say Bach, it turned out that one of his pieces, you could actually play it on a Mobius strip. And it's set up in such a way that at a certain point, it wraps around, but sort of the notes flip over. And so, wow. You know, there's all these, was it intentional or not? I don't know, maybe, who knows? But there's a lot of interesting patterns. And really, so this is Ron Graham would say this. You say, you know, mathematics is the study of patterns. And juggling is the art of controlling patterns. And when you see that, like, okay, so yeah, it makes sense. There's definitely some overlap happening because it's all about patterns.
You mentioned Dr. Ram Graham. You worked with him and Ardos on the paper. What was working with him like?
Well, so I worked with Ron for, oh boy, I don't know, maybe a dozen years. So I got to know him really well, actually, for a while. So I was a student of Fan Cheng, who was Ron Graham's spouse. And when I was going to graduate school, my wife had a job in the neighboring county and did not like driving. So it's like, okay, we moved to be near her job. And so I started sleeping in the office. And well, people heard about that. Like, oh, that's a... And so my advisor said, okay, look, just, you can come sleep in our basement. And so over time, you know, I actually, you know, not just worked with him, but in some sense, I was living there part-time and became a part of the family. And So Ron is a unique individual. Not a lot of people who are like him. And so, I mean, what was it like working with Ron? So Ron was great at coming up with problems because he was a great communicator in some sense. He was great at, and not necessarily just, he was great at explaining things, but he had like networks of people that he could tap into, and he would have people would come to him and say, hey, I have this great problem. What do you think? And he might have an insight and help to say, hey, here's a great place to start. Or say, you know, this would be a great problem for so-and-so, and get people connected. And for Ron, what did he like to do? Well, he would, he liked looking at data, finding patterns. He always had his notepads, and let's see, I don't know if I have one handy. Not right in arm's reach. But he liked, if you've ever seen these notepads, which is, it's grid paper. And he would just write copious notes, and he, almost like a flow of consciousness, like, what am I thinking about this problem? And so you could read, you know, it's like, oh, I forgot. And so he would explore, and he would keep all his notes. So after Ron passed away, I actually got them. And so I have like a wall, literally a big wall in my house is just his notes. And it's going to take me, well, it took him, you know, like 60 years to put it all together. It's going to take me a couple of years to get through it all.
Yeah.
And so he would think about things. And one of the interesting things about Ron, and I'm sorry, I'm going to go off on a lot of tangents here.
Please,
I'm just going to warn
please
you
do,
ahead
please
of time.
Please do.
I do want to point out, this is why I'm such a good calculus teacher, because of all the tangents I do. we would go and we'd visit people. We would go watch movies. He almost went and saw every movie that came out. You know, he'd keep up with sports. In the morning, he'd go to Starbucks and have a conversation with people about the news. And I thought, like, how are you doing math? And then, we did math. And I would occasionally, he'd say, you know, I was lying in bed at 3 a.m. this morning thinking about the problem, and I had an idea. And lo and behold, it was the right idea. You know, it's like, wow, that's amazing. I wish I was that good at 3 a.m. in the morning. I just think he had this sort of ability to always be thinking about math. And I don't want to make it sound superhuman. If you look at everything that he did, it can definitely come across that way, because we can start listing accomplishments and it just doesn't seem to stop his list of achievements. It was more of a matter of just sort of persistence and practice. You know, he had spent so long looking at data and exploring, he became good at sort of picking up patterns. There was a paper we were working on once where I had some data generated, and I sent him some data, and a few weeks later he said, I think I have a guess. And it was this not easy looking formula, and I was like, well, that's sort of a weird guess, but it's like, okay, let me see. I think I can compute one more case. And it was right. And I was like, how in the world did you see that? Like, what? How? Where did that come from? And so he explained it to me. So this is things he had learned, you know, tricks of the trade. Like, all right, we're letting you in on a little bit of a secret here. Yeah. And so what he did was he took the data and he factored it. And you're like, okay, well, why was that useful? Well, he saw all the prime factors were small. And so when you see that all the prime factors are small, that usually means multiplication of binomial coefficients and small powers. And so he said, okay, that's my goal. It's like, okay, how can I write this as some product of some binomial coefficients and small powers? And he played around with it and he found one that worked. So that was his guess. And once we had the guess, of course, we were able to sort of figure it out. But when I first saw that, I was like, wow, how? And of course, once he explained, it's like, I was still like, wow, that's amazing. But you know, it's like,
yeah,
it's possible. Let me share with you something that my advisor shared with me. So this is Fan Chung, and She was, for many decades, she worked at Bell Labs, and for a while she was a manager. So she worked with the best and brightest in the field. Like, everybody knew Fan. Everybody still knows Fan. I mean, she's just hugely influential. And she would talk about how you had these genius mathematicians who would prove a big result, and then you would never see anything else from them again. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you'd have people who weren't like these brilliant geniuses. They were, you know, they were smart, but not like by any means like these super smart people, like normal people, but they worked. And those were, in her mind, the great mathematicians, because they were able to produce and produce consistently. And so I think that sometimes when we look at people who make these amazing, you know, leaps and bounds, and we're like, oh, they're, you know, they must be geniuses. I think there's just a bit of genius to that, but a lot of it comes from saying, I've worked a lot in the past, and I said, aha, I've seen something like this before. Mm-hmm. And you start to sense patterns, and when you learn these patterns, it becomes second nature. And those are the things that people translate into our intuition, you know. Mm-hmm. Says this is the right thing to do. Well, it's because it was the right thing to do before, you know, 10 other times. And so a lot of mathematicians, when you go and look at, you know, their work, you'll see that, oh, you know, this mathematician has a few very good tools that they know how to use really well. Mm-hmm. And they'll go alone. He has like combinatorial Stollensatz and probabilistic method. And he knows those tools and he knows them really, really well. And I mean, I'm not saying those are the only things he uses, but like that's a great tool set to have. And so he's able to take that and do lots of wonderful things just because he's had so much practice with it. And you develop it with time. I've had some good students. I do think that I've had students who have definitely been frustrated at times because, you know, it's easy to sort of have this maybe a romantic view of mathematics, where it's like, you know, it's like math is done on you have like a whiteboard marker and you're writing on your window, and you know, and like dramatic music is playing in the background, and everything just works, and you never make a mistake, you're never stuck. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to realize, you know, math is not like that for the majority of people. And it's really more about trying to understand things. And that, you know, with time, you can solve problems. And you're going to make lots of mistakes. You know, you look at the way that problems are often first solved, it's terrible. I once solved a problem. I was proud of the solution, by the way. But it took me like 3-4 pages, and I had these really crazy pictures there. But you know, I was like, okay, great. And then a few days later, I realized I could take it down to like 4 or 5 sentences, and it just like book proof comes out super clean, totally intuitive. And okay, well, wait, which proof was right? Well, they're both right, you know, but the first proof, it's not a bad proof. It's just, it takes time and insight. Now, the problem, of course, is that when students see proofs, they always see like the book proofs, you know, these really elegant proofs. And they get this perception like, okay, every proof was like that. No, almost no proofs are like that to begin. It takes time to get to that stage. Because Ron actually was organized and had beautiful handwriting. Erdős did not have beautiful handwriting. I know, because I have like a small stack of Erdős letters, and I go through and try to read them, like, ah, what are these words? I know it's English too, so. I do find it helpful to write. And sometimes even the process of just writing things down, you start to see, oh, I see there's a gap in the knowledge. So I mentioned Math of Juggling. I was writing up sort of a quick sort of introduction to Math of Juggling. And then I saw, oh, wait, hold on. There's this piece here that's not been done properly. And now that I actually have been writing it, I can see the missing piece and I can see how to fill that piece in. And I went on and I got to work with some high school students from South Korea, and we were able to fill that piece in. And so I do think it does help tremendously to write things down. Let me mention, so Paul Erdős, you know, most people think about his letters, but he also was very good at keeping a journal. And so the way he would oftentimes keep a journal is, you know, he'd write down what would happen, but he also left very generous margins because then he would later go on and add commentary, you know, like, oh yeah, this was right. You know, so-and-so was verify this, or no, I was thinking about this the wrong way. And so that, you know, there's this nice resource that he can refer back to.
If you could go back in time, what advice would you give yourself?
I probably, you know, this is my own personal weaknesses here. So this probably will not apply to any of you, but I'm not a very good social person. And I'm not antisocial. I don't want to say that, but if I go, say, to a party, if you engage me in conversation, it'll be a great conversation, but I won't tend to initiate it. Is mathematics is very highly collaborative. And I know this is very true in discrete mathematics, but even outside of discrete mathematics, you know, math is a human activity and requires you to interact with people and to get to know people. And I don't think you can get the full enjoyment out of math and even the full power of out of math in isolation. And so I would say that my advice is to talk to people, you know, try to get out of your comfort zone and form relationships. And, you know, these can be good mathematically, but they can also be very important for you as you go on throughout your career. Oftentimes the way people land positions and get jobs and get opportunities is they learn about it from a network of people that they know. And you might also know people and never actually collaborate with it necessarily. Hmm. You know, I have people who I've worked with for years doing other things. So Mike Farrar is an example. He's now works at the National Science Foundation in the US. And well, you know, we knew each other for quite a long time, and we've worked together in organizing workshops. We've never once talked about doing a research problem together, but our friendship has proven to be, you know, tremendously helpful and beneficial. And we certainly have relied on each other. And so to your question, again, it's what advice would I give? Talk to more people and get out there, meet more people, try to get out to conferences and build up a little bit of courage to talk to people. And you'll discover there's some friendly people out there. There are some occasionally not friendly people. That's okay. Don't have to work with them.
How do you choose problems to work on?
Well, I'm very fortunate in my current position. I don't have to worry about grants too much right now. For me, it's mostly what do I enjoy doing and who do I enjoy working with? And one of the reasons I worked so much with Ron was I loved working with Ron. He was just it was fun because it was interesting problems. But I also like working with undergraduates and I like working with graduates. And, you know, I will say, you know, I'm not like only Ramsey Theater. I've done a few things in Ramsey Theater, but I've done things in lots of other stuff, which is great. You know, there's so much math out there. And I think it's important to not try to say, you know, I'm only going to focus on this one little area of math. Mm-hmm. And I know that there are some people who, sometimes they have their publishing career, it feels like they're doing it by induction. It's like, okay, last year I did the case for 3. This year I'm going to publish the case for 4. The next year I'm doing 5. You know, like that's not how we're supposed to work, you know?
Yeah.
You should do something. And I think it was Gilbert Strang wrote this advice. He said, all right, you know, we're mathematicians. We've learned something. we can learn something again. And so you should make a contribution and then move on and do something else. And don't get stuck in one little piece. And that doesn't mean you have to change completely different, but this says, you know, don't keep it too hyper-focused. There's lots of problems out there. And find something that you enjoy doing.
Do you think about like the bigger implication that your work has? Like, I think in one of your paper, I think it's on your website, it's related to genetic modification as well. I think it's the science of juggling or science of card tricks. It's like related to genetic modification and study of genetics as well. So do you think about that as well? Like the implication that it's going to have for, you know, like the humankind?
Well, I don't worry too much about that. I don't consider myself an applied mathematician, but you know, if things have an application, I that would be great. But for me, I want people to understand things, and I highly value that. And so, oftentimes when I try to think about, you know, the math, I really want people to say, all right, what am I learning? What do I get out of this? So Ron, and I have a lot of stories about Ron because I spent, like I said, I lived with him and he, amazing, amazing life. He wrote a paper on the smallest large hexagon, or is it the largest small hexagon? One of those two. And so what is it? So take a hexagon, and it has to have unit diameter, which means that no two points are more than distance one apart. All right. Now there's lots of hexagons like that. So now the question is, well, which hexagon among all of those is the best in terms of area? You want to maximize the area. And all right, well, the first gut reaction is, well, the normal, regular hexagon. No, that's not right. It turns out that you can create a shape. It looks a little bit like a pentagon. It's not exactly a pentagon, but it looks like you took a pentagon and then you poked one side out a little bit. And if you put it up just right, you can get a little bit more area, like 3 or 4% more area. And all right, so that's a geometrical result. And you can ask this, of course, for any n-gon. Turns out if it's an odd number, you know, 5, 7, 9, it is the regular odd-gon. That's the best. You can't do better than that. But when it's even, you know, maybe you can do better. So Ron did 6. Not that long ago, somebody did 8, a small group. And I don't think anyone's done 10 yet. Okay, so, but application. So he got a request. He said, hey, you know, I saw your paper and I run a company that does things for like memorial markers for when people pass away. We think we could use this shape. Is it okay for us to use this shape to make these markers? And, you know, he had all these plans and it's like, wow, okay. Never had that application in mind. There's another mathematician who you may have heard of, Joel Spencer. And he's a very good Ramsey theorist, also very great person. I really like Joel. And he liked the result too. So what he did was he actually built a sandbox for his kids and he used that exact shape. And well, the problem, of course, it's kind of hard to get that exactly. So, you know, but he figured out how to do it, so.
Was there a particular reason that, you know, this company used that, or did they just like the design?
Well, it's, you know, design, somehow it's efficient, right? There's this sort of optimization that goes on.
Oh, okay. And
so it's like, okay, well, maybe this is the best design in some sense.
On the Iowa State website, it also says you were at a state fair and you were doing magic tricks. And you were also telling people how you were doing them. So has the magician tribunal come after you for revealing the tricks?
It is very interesting how magicians have a very different perspective. They want you to, you know, they don't want you to know how things are done. Mm-hmm. And so they usually don't like to show you the same thing twice. And on the other hand, jugglers, they're the complete opposite. They desperately want you to see it. And they would be very happy to help you get started in learning how to do it. So this was a paper with Percy Diakonis and Ron Graham. We started talking about shuffling. I actually went to visit with Ron because he has this great house in San Diego right on the ocean. And you could just sit there and watch the ocean. And he said, "All right, Steve, we're gonna learn how to perfectly shuffle cards." And if you're familiar with that, imagine the fingers are the cards. It means you cut it exactly in half, and then you exactly every other, so interlace. And I know Ron had connections to to the magic community for many years. And okay, great. This will be wonderful. I'll learn from a pro. And then Ron said, "I don't know how to do it." But you know, I saw people. It's like you do this, you do that. We can figure it out. And we spent probably like 2 or 3 days. And boy, I must have destroyed several decks, you know, because it's not automatic. Mm-hmm. And so after about the third day of doing this for hours a day, I gave up hope. Like, oh, I'm never going to be able to do this. But maybe I can do a part of it, which is cut the deck in half. So I cut the deck in half. And then I said, well, I'm too lazy. I don't want to count. So I'm just going to eyeball to check to see did I actually get it in half. And then I was looking at it, and I was just comparing the two sides, and I sort of nudged them together. And then they went, zoop. What? And I was like, oh, my gosh, it actually works. And like, wait, hold on. And I started figuring out the mechanics. And within a few hours after that, I was like, all right, Drew, I was doing perfect shuffles, and which is not so bad. It's actually a lot easier to learn than you magicians want you to think. Magicians want you to think it's hard because, you know, that way, very magical. No, it's not that hard. You know, it can be learned.
I see.
So I learned to shuffle, and then we wrote a paper about another type of shuffle. So the other type of shuffle, so instead of doing this, what you would do is you would first flip, and then you would interlace. So there's a sort of extra motion going on. And we called it a horseshoe, because if you look at where the cards end up, it sort of forms a horseshoe compared to where the cards started. And wrote a paper. Percy Diakonis was on the paper. And it was a nice paper. We were basically winding it down. And then Percy said, this is a great paper. But where's the trick? What? No, we have to have a magic trick, you know. What? And so I had to come up with a magic trick based off of the math. And so I actually came up with a really, in my opinion, pretty decent trick where you give somebody a small deck of cards, 8 cards, and arrange in a particular order. And then you say, okay, look, I'll teach you about 5 different ways to shuffle. And so you teach them 5 different ways. And now you say, okay, do those shuffles as much as you want. I'll look away. And when you're convinced I can't possibly know the cards, let me know. Okay. So that the great thing is that the spectator has control over the cards like the whole time. Mm-hmm. And they're shuffling. And they really are genuinely shuffling. And then you say, okay, now deal them down. You know, there's 8 cards, so you make 2 rows of 4. And it's like, okay, I'm going to try to figure out your cards. Oh, give me one clue. It's like, okay, so they turn the card over. And you're like, oh, I can tell you this other card here. You're like, wow, that's great. One more clue. So they turn one more card over. And then you just keep going, dot, 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 dot. And you name all the cards. And you can get them, every single one.
How long did it take you to make up that trick?
Well, the first draft, the one that's actually published, is not the best version of it. But that one, it took me a couple of days to sort of think about how to do it. There's a great book by Ron and Percy called Magical Mathematics. Mm-hmm. And where there's a whole bunch of different card tricks that they put together and lots of fun ideas. And so that's the one I'm familiar with. There's other mathematicians who I've met who really love card tricks as well, Cole McKay. But you know, there's actually he wrote a book about magical effects. I'm in the book. There's something called the subtler bracelet. Well, subtler is a rearrangement of butlers. And so there's this special way you can arrange the cards from 1 to 10 that have a really unusual property. And I found that out. And having come up with the trick, I don't know if there's like a great science to it. It's just sort of you play around with it. But we had to come up with it related to the math. So it turns out for cards, interesting things happen for powers of two when it comes to shuffling. And by interesting, I mean not very many things can happen. So usually when you have a deck of cards and you shuffle, even if you say, oh, I can only shuffle it under a few rules, there's lots and lots of possibilities. There's this sort of huge explosion of possibilities. But when you have a power of two, there's somehow this beautiful collapsing that comes in. And so all of a sudden, instead of having millions of combinations, now you have like 30 combinations. And it's like, okay, there's something we can do here. And that's sort of where the magic comes in, is figuring out how can I sort of exploit this idea? And in particular, the idea is like, okay, you make people think that there's lots of different things that are possible. And give them the sense of control. You know, I think that's what a lot of magic is give the person like somehow a sense of control, a sense of randomness. But really secretly, you know, like there's really weren't that many things. It's really not that random. And then figure out how to somehow figure that out is the fun part.
Like, were you always, like, since you were, you know, since high school, always this passionate, or is this like a taste you developed, like, you know, beer or, you know, wine, or is it like genetics or whatever?
That's an interesting way to phrase it. I've actually never had beer or wine, so I have no idea if I have a taste for it. But you mentioned high school. When I was taking algebra in high school, I got like a C in the subject. I got better. So I think it, you know, there is something that sort of flipped the switch for me around, maybe it was 10th grade. And I think it was my trigonometry class that really did it for me. I loved my trigonometry class and I just threw myself into it. And my calculus teacher, I like to tell people, you know, he had three jobs at the school. He taught driver's ed. He was the assistant football coach. And then he taught calculus. So, you know, not the most inspiring calculus teacher, but there was, somehow it clicked for me and it did really well. But I think the way I really developed my style was when I was an undergraduate. So a lot of the things I do now are just sort of echoes of things that I picked up when I was an undergraduate, because the school I was at had this help room for math. And I would go in, I would get to work with people, and sort of I learned to sort of pick up, like, okay, what's your question that you're asking? But what's your real question? Mm-hmm. Where's your mistake? How can I sort of make you engaged in this process, you know, have fun with you? And sort of like oversell, become very, whoa, you know. And sometimes I tell people, you know, teaching is kind of performance based. And so my students know that I can get sort of very silly at times and overly excited. But I think it helps them say, oh, wow, there's something going on here. So I have... and this will probably get me in trouble with the French, but you know, talk about L'Hôpital's room. I go, oh, L'Hôpital, mon ami. Oh, And so, students, after a while, after I do that for a couple of times, it's like, oh, it's L'Hôpital, right? Oh, yeah, exactly. Oh, and they make the noise too. And so they get a kick out of it. And so it's fun.
So when you went into university first, were you planning on doing doctorates in mathematics, or it just happened?
Well, I was very fortunate to grow up. My dad is actually a professor, and he was a professor of economics. So I was in a university town. So my last year of high school, I got to take some classes at the university. And one of them was engineering for mathematical engineering. I can't remember the phrase of it, but I did part of that class. No big challenges. And then the other one I remember, because there were a couple things that happened in that class, was linear algebra. And the two things I remember was how here I was, this high school student, and the instructor had challenged us with the question, and I was the only one to figure it out. I was like, wow, that's good. That feels good. And then the other thing that happened was we had a guest lecturer. His name was Jim Cannon. He's a very good low-dimensional topologist. And the reason I remember that guest lecture is that somebody had the audacity to ask, what do we use this linear algebra stuff for? You're never supposed to ask the instructor what this is for. But he answered it, and I remember his answer. And ever since that answer, I have used that answer for like almost all of my calculus classes. The answer he gave, and I paraphrase it so much, so that it's not verbatim, but this is very close to verbatim, is that we're really good at understanding flat things, lines, rectangles, boxes. But the world around us isn't flat. There's curves, there's bumpy things. And so what calculus does is helps understand the world around us by approximating everything by flat things. And of course, and that's the part I care about. The linear algebra says, here's how you understand flat things. And so that's why linear algebra is important. How do you understand flat things? I remember that class. When I started university, I was thinking about computer programming, and even maybe thinking going, I liked movies, special effects. I thought, well, okay, be a programmer. Then I took a programming class. It was supremely boring. And so I was like, okay, I'm out. And in the meantime, I had taken math classes and I was doing great. And so my freshman year, I took only math classes. And then basically I'd run out of math classes at the undergraduate level. So my sophomore year, I just took graduate math classes. And then that was fun again, because it was like me versus the graduate students, and I was beating them. I was like, yes, this is great. I love this. And then of course, my junior year, I really ran into trouble. I kind of squeezed out the very last math classes I could. And I was like, uh-oh, well, all right, start doing another degree. So I started economics. I also have a degree in economics. And then in my senior year, last semester, I was like, oh, wait, I'm supposed to do general ed stuff, aren't I? And so I crammed in almost all my general eds in 1.5 semesters. So
wow.
That was my undergraduate career. But I think when I saw I was good at math and I actually had fun doing it, I thought, well, okay, I can do this. And I enjoyed teaching people. Mm. Honestly, I really see myself as a teacher. And I suspect that will be my greatest contribution. One of my co-authors was Warwick Delaney. He's was very good. He passed away a few years ago now. I only had a chance to meet him for like a little bit. But he said, for most mathematicians, the most important thing that they will do is in the classroom. It's not the theorems they're going to prove, the papers they're going to write. It's the work they're going to do in the classroom. And I am 100% convinced that, you know, 100 years from now, no one's going to be talking about Butler's theorem all the time. Maybe somebody will see something I wrote. But the students that I have taught, well, they'll be dead. But they'll have kept that spirit alive for a few generations. That's how I plan to make my mark on the world.
Especially Ramsey theory, there's a little phrase, I think it's called, it goes, true chaos is impossible. Do you see a metaphysical, you know, importance of that? I don't know like how much you are, you know, philosopher or not, but have you thought about that?
Yeah, I think the phrase I've heard is complete disorder is impossible. In terms of, I'm not a philosopher. And so I haven't thought really more about that, other than I think it's important for people to realize that sometimes a coincidence is a coincidence. And I think sometimes, I should be careful what I say here, because I worry I might say something offensive to some people. There's this tendency now to see that there's this a reason for everything. Mm-hmm. And so where the reason may not be immediately obvious, now people start saying, well, let me come up with a spurious reason. And there's this tendency now for conspiracies. And I think that it seems like that's much more acceptable today than it used to be. And I worry that people mistake coincidences for some deeper meaning, because mm-hmm. we know, you know, things happen. By pure randomness, you might have things line up, and you have to learn to recognize that says, hey, no, we know the mathematics. We know that this is not as profound as you think. You mm-hmm. know, take a step back and make sure. I think that's maybe the only comment I have on that. So, well, I post my lectures online, so...
looking them up now.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Butler. It was a pleasure having you with us.
Yeah, it was great to talk to you.
Yeah, hopefully we'll write a paper together if I decide to go.
Yeah, getting that Erdős number 2, right?
Erdős number 2. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the Erdős numbers?
Yes. Oh, we forgot to mention that you have Erdős number 1.
Yeah. I'm the 512th person to get Erdős number 1.
And that's the last, right?
Well, as of now,
yeah,
there might be another one. But 512 is a great place to stop, because, you know, that's 2 to the power 9.
Yeah.
And in binary, that's a beautiful number. That's 1 with a bunch of zeros afterward.
Thank you, Dr. Steve Butler, for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with us on Ramsey Theory Podcast. We truly appreciate the answers you shared with us today, and I am sure they will be of great use to the general public.
Happy to help.
Yep.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Nice to meet you. Bye.
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 And thank you to everyone listening to our podcast today. We hope you learn a bit more about Dr. Steve Butler, a prominent 21st century mathematician. We have been Anmol,
Amrita,
and Brian.
This has been Ramsey Theory. No strangers at this party.
Broadcasting live from the traditional territories of the Tsleil-Waututh, Kukwetlam, Skahomish, and Musqueam nations, this has been Ramsey Theory, no strangers at this party. This podcast was made possible by the students of Simon Fraser University's Ramsey Theory course, led by Dr. Veselin Yungic, who is also the producer of this series, as well as funding from the Mathcatcher Outreach Program. My name is Aidan Wright, I'm the editor of this project. I currently study at the University of Victoria. The soundtrack to this program is titled Rising Ronald in Memory of Ronald Graham. It was written by Nina Jokic, another alumnus of the Simon Fraser University Ramsey Theory course. Tune in again soon for more of the latest in Ramsey Theory, and to hear more from mathematicians working at the edge of human knowledge. Thank you for listening.